Adventurer, route maker, writer, non-profit founder, and outspoken activist, Sarah Swallow, this week on Thereabouts Outspoken.
Anyway, you guys got a lot of grit.
Hi, hello, g'day, howdy, how are you, how you doing, where are you at? Welcome to another episode of Thereabouts Outspoken. My name is Angus Morton, and as always, I am joined via the Ethernet cable by Isaac Carson. G'day, mate. What's happening in the Pacific Northwest?
Not a lot. Yeah, things are good. And yeah, it's interesting that the cable you speak of is the only thing keeping everybody connected. But I'm really excited to have Sarah on the podcast, who is responsible for you and I meeting, actually.
Yeah, that's right. She is indeed. 'Twas a dark and frigid night in the southern Arizona desert, if I recall correctly, when you rolled into the finish of Ruta del Jefe, and we shared a beer together. And there the relationship was born. What a day. And that does bring us to the focus of today's episode. I first met Sarah a little over a year back, actually, just probably about a week or so before you and I met Isaac, after I'd been commissioned to make a film about the bike event she was putting on called the Ruta del Jefe, which is named after the famous jaguar that inhabited the region the event takes place in, which is the Sky Islands in the southern Arizona borderlands.
It's one of the most biodiverse regions in the U.S., and it's also facing numerous environmental and humanitarian issues. From the threat of mineral extraction to the unnecessary deaths of migrants crossing the border.
The goal of the event is to raise awareness for the region, and in the lead up to it, we spent several days interviewing a range of experts from different organizations, from people like No More Deaths through to the Arizona Trail Association, each with a vested interest in protecting a specific element in the region. And this event brought them all together.
With a route that can only be described as breathtaking, the event highlighted for us the ability of sport to showcase a region under threat, as well as bring together all of those with an interest in protecting the area under one experience to further educate and inform the racing participants. It was an event that really brought Gus and I together and focused us to define the new mission of Thereabouts, which is using sport to help people understand the world.
This is only one bow in the plethora of Sarah Swallow, and so we sat down with her to better understand how she came to view the bike in the way that she does, and how she plans to use it to keep fighting for the issues she cares about. G'day, Sarah. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm happy to be here. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Whereabouts are you in lockdown?
I am also in Colorado. I'm in Durango, and I feel in a similar position. I feel very fortunate. The weather has been really perfect over the past few weeks, and sunny and warm, and just lots of rides. And our cases are still really low here, another fortunate situation. Things have been canceled, but I'm grateful for the place that I'm at right now.
And that's what I have to ask you, right? Like, I understand you're you're semi-nomadic, I guess you would say, right? You sort of travel most of the year. Like, what happens to a person who's semi-nomadic when they're told to stay at home?
I had a small, time of a bit of an identity crisis. And because really this is the first time in 5 years that I've been forced to stay in one place. And when I've tried to do this in the past, I'll be in a place for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or even a month, but then I'll be I'll get pretty anxious and need to get on the road, just go somewhere, go on a bike tour, camp out, because it's that kind of day-to-day rhythm of just like supporting your needs while you're living on the road, whether it's bike touring or car camping, which I do all three. I do the bike touring. I do, you know, I travel in a camp, a truck with a camper on it, and do trips out of there. And then my partner has a house in Durango. So I bounce between three different things. And, yeah, so it was tough, the first couple weeks for me, coming back. And the weather wasn't so good either. So that kind of forced things. But to be honest, like after that, like period of time of just like, okay, you know, I can't, you know, I just have to accept that this is reality. You know, there's nothing I can do about it. So don't fight those feelings, just kind of, go towards them and accept them. And, I've just really kind of come to peace with the fact that like, I kind of needed this, like I kind of need to, just chill out for a little bit and like get to know this place that I'm calling my home. And also just like take care of myself. Like I am like, when I am not bike touring or traveling and like riding my bike, I am constantly like working on an event or just working on different things for WTF Bike Explorers. And I'm just constantly consuming my spare time with work, like, and not necessarily much else. So during this time, I've been just like kind of more focusing on just me and like reading books that I've been wanting to read and like poring over maps of Durango to try to find like different things and like linking up new routes and rafting down the river. I tried river wave surfing the other day and yeah, it's just like, so I'm just kind of in that mindset right now.
What's river wave surfing look like?
River wave surfing looks like just like normal surfing, but instead of like having to ride a whole wave into the beach and then swim back out, you just ride one wave that's just happening inside of a river.
That sounds pretty good, surfing a few thousand miles from the nearest beach. You said this morning, you said before we jumped on, like that you have a bit of a bike hangover today. I want to know how are you being creative with your routes, knowing that you're kind of restricted to a 10-mile radius at the moment?
Yeah, well, luckily, like in Durango, within a 10-mile radius, there's probably over 300 miles of single track. Like, so I don't have to go very far. But the problem is that there are like three locations that people tend to go to. And so there's just, you know, all of, you know, work-free Durango, school-free Durango are at these like three different places. So what I've been doing most days, like on a day-to-day basis, I kind of like spend my, mornings, you know, I do yoga and then, I kind of spend the middle of the day, working on stuff or reading or doing bike stuff. And then like around 3 or 4, I'll go out for a ride and that'll either be, like on the single track, you know, the local trails, but I can pretty much do a different thing every day if I want to. And so I've just been trying to link up these, you know, different 30-mile loops of double tracks and dirt roads and trying to stay off pavement as much as possible.
It sounds like you're doing all right in lockdown. It sounds like you're at least able to have a pretty good adventure in a relatively tight proximity, which sounds like, it sounds awesome.
Yeah, and it's like it's keeping me like motivated and inspired, you know, because like it's really easy right now to just get consumed in like the news and like social media. And for me, I just need to be able to kind of escape that and kind of like fuel my soul in the same way that, you know, bike tours do and traveling does. And really it's just great to be able to get that feeling, you know, 10 miles from home.
I want to talk about what you're doing now, but before we get there, I kind of want to get your story with the bike. Can you tell us, when did you first turn the pedals?
I don't remember like the exact moment, but I learned in a cul-de-sac in Southern California when I was like 6, I think, on a navy blue boys bike with even blue tread tires. It was just hand-me-down from my 2 siblings ahead of me. So I learned how to pedal at an early age. And I remember just when I was a kid, just riding with my dad, who was always training for marathons a lot. And so we would like ride with him on the bike trail when he on his long runs and stuff. We moved to Ohio when I was 9 or 10. And when I was 12, I got a job. I don't really remember riding other than just like down the street to my friend's house. And I never really thought about the bike. But when I was 12, I got a job at a bike rental on this 70-mile long bike path along the Little Miami River in Ohio. And that was my first like introduction to like the kind of joy that bicycles bring to people, because people would come from all over to come rent, you know, these cruiser bikes. And once I started riding those cruiser bikes to like put them away into the shed and realizing like how comfortable it was to like sit upright on like this super plush seat and pedal, like I was like, wow, this is amazing. And so I worked there for a while, and I just learned that I really liked working with bikes, honestly, like then. The next kind of phase for me was graduating from high school. And, you know, in high school, I had been a field hockey player. And so I was always like really, you know, always like working out for field hockey and running. And so when that was over, I was looking for a new kind of sport to pick up. And my dad, a few years earlier, had picked up cycling because he couldn't run anymore after his marathon. So he had picked up cycling, and my mom had picked it up a little bit. And so they had road bikes. And so I started borrowing my mom's road bike and riding with my dad and doing longer rides. So then I decided to get a job at a bike shop. And so it was kind of like I started falling in love with riding bikes at the same time I was falling in love with working with them too. I got a job at a bike shop, and just through the bike shop, I just got more into like mountain biking and just all kinds of riding. I just liked all of it. Like I did triathlon, cyclocross, road riding. And
so you pretty quickly got into traveling. Like competition.
I did a few triathlons. I do competitions out of the challenge. Like my dad always signs up for events to challenge himself. So like my first century was the assault on Mount Mitchell in North Carolina, which is like that 100-mile ride up Mount Mitchell. And that was my first century because it's like, you know, it's just like a challenge, you know? And, I've participated in a lot of events, but I wouldn't say that I've really raced very much until maybe like last year, not even that.
and you say, right. Like how did you go from there to then like owning your own bike shop? And like, how did you decide like that you were kind of going to make cycling like, you know, your life?
I remember just through working at the bike rental and working at the bike shop, I remember telling my my history professor, I graduated with a degree in history, and I remember telling her as I was graduating that I think that I'm going to own my own bike shop, and just because that's what I want to do, you know, like that's what I'm interested in doing. Like I'm kind of an entrepreneur, have this entrepreneur mm-hmm. spirit about me. And I just thought it was something that I could do and I could do well. And so I pursued that route with my partner at the time, and yeah, we had a lot of fun, and we did it under the premise that we were going to not, you know, sacrifice our riding. And so we pushed ourselves to like try new things. And so actually when we first started our bike shop was when we first started doing more, gravel rides and gravel exploring, and then eventually bike touring. So we really fell into gravel riding and bike touring as we, you know, progressed with the bike shop, and our bike shop kind of reflected that, and that's what we would sell and push to our customers and through our marketing. And at the time no one was doing that in Cincinnati. No one was really riding gravel at all.
How long did you run the bike shop, and then what kind of made you decide to decide to close down and have what was, you know, can only be described as a pretty epic gravel adventure across the US?
Yeah, we had the shop for 5 years, and I think around, it was tough, you know, we were in a, it was just us two, and we kind of just evolved the business as we just let the business kind of like go the way our customers were pushing us, and also the way we wanted to go. But we started small, and but we opened in the same location that this shop had existed for 20 years. So we opened in a location where a shop had existed for 20 years and that we had both worked at. And so we were really popular right away. And, you know, our goal was to like kind of, you know, focus on these things that we wanted to do, and also stay small. But, you know, the community wanted us to be bigger. and you know, in hindsight, you know, we didn't know how to manage that, you know, initial, like just how busy we were for how small we wanted to be. But we did it for a while. And I think around year four, we kind of looked at each other and we're like, you know, is this what we want for, you know, for the rest of our lives? Like, are we really happy doing this? And the answer is no, you know, like there are a lot of really wonderful things about owning a bike shop and getting to be part of a community that a bike shop kind of brings together. And I love that aspect of it. But on the other hand, there is just so many other aspects that can kind of keep people from really living their lives for themselves too. And we were young. I don't know how old we were, but it was 2015. I had been offered kind of like a grant sponsorship from Specialized at the time, and I just wanted to use that for something, you know, something that, you know, really inspired me. And I had always wanted to ride across the country, but I never wanted to do it on dirt roads. And I mean, I'd never wanted to do it on pavement, which were all the routes that were available. And so I started digging, and then I found this dual sport motorcycle route called the TAT. And I just like researched it a bunch, and I was like, yeah, this seems like totally doable on bike. And so we kind of like set the date and planned to move out. And actually there's kind of a funny side story to our move out, because our location, the shop next door, the business next door was this like this boxing, CrossFit boxing gym. And when they moved in, the landlord, you know, required them to put sound insulation so that the sound wouldn't be transferred into their neighbor's space. And so they did, but they put like the cheapest sound insulation money could buy. And so like every morning when I would show up at work, there'd be like, and like these like really intense like beats going. And you know, you'd be like checking a customer out, like, you know, taking their money, and they'd be like, and it would just be like, you know, this is, it would drive me insane. So I was constantly fighting that through like legal letters between my landlord and with my landlord and stuff, and trying to find loopholes that, you know, either we could get out of the lease or they could be forced to do something about the sound. And I couldn't, there was no way, I couldn't find a way of getting out of the lease. You know, I was pretty much stuck there. And, but, you know, around the same time we were like planning on moving out, the landlord came to, we couldn't move out. We were just going to close the shop for the tour for like 3 months and then come back to the shop and figure it out. But like a month before we were going to leave, the landlord, the general manager came in with a bunch of paperwork asking us to notarize our lease. And I was like, I'm not going to notarize our lease. And so I do a little Google searching. They were trying to sell the building that we were in. So they were giving me paperwork to like, so they could button up things and give it, hand it over. But just a little Google search found that if my lease wasn't notarized upon signing, that really technically my lease is just a month to month. So I was able to just send in a month notice saying, hey, you know, our lease is actually obsolete and we're moving out. And so we ended up moving out of the bike shop in like 1 week and packing and going for that tour. But really it was kind of capitalizing on the fact that we were able to get out of our lease legally.
And then talk me through this, the TAT route, right? The 5,000 mile gravel route. Had you ever done anything remotely like that beforehand? And what was that experience like for you?
Yeah, that was the first thing, anything like that. We had gone on a few tours, like a 5-day tour and a 3-day tour, maybe a 7-day tour max. But nothing to that degree at all. And, but you know, I would have to say I was probably more prepared on that tour than, you know, I probably am for most of my tours now, just because you just focus so much on, you know, having the proper gear and being prepared. But my body physically, you know, obviously was not, you know, prepared for that kind of thing. Like I remember the first 2 weeks were like really hard, but again, we did, you know, we were riding like 100 miles a day until we got to like between 70 and 100 miles a day until we got to like Colorado. So we were putting big miles in. You know, I remember there's a specific time in Mississippi where we got super stuck in the mud, like this just sticky peanut butter mud for miles and miles. And I was just like, what am I even doing here? You know, like I am such an amateur. Like, why am I, you know, why did I think I was capable of doing it? You know, and this was like the point, the one point that I got to, and I was like, I'm just thought about getting on a bus and just ending the tour. And then my partner Tom was just like, no, you know, you can't turn back. You gotta stay true to the course. And once I was over that little hump, it was like I just really fell into it and just loved it. Like I just loved the day-to-day feeling of pedaling to get to the next place and just kind of like the freedom of of riding a bike and just just focusing on your needs for the day, each day.
And I mean, it must have had a pretty profound impact, because as far as I'm aware, right, you sort of, like, since that journey, you've kind of been relatively semi-nomadic, and you've also, like, your life has been revolved around traveling by bike, by routes, by writing about bikes, and also doing activism surrounding cycling. Firstly, though, like, how long has it been that you've been living, I guess, this semi-nomadic life, and you know, what do you love about it?
Yeah, I mean, that was, I guess that was the point, because I was like on the tat, I was like, this is really the happiest place that I am, is on my bike and doing this. And so I love, you know, and I also was exposed to people on that trip mm-hmm. that were living alternative lifestyles that weren't focused on, like, you know, working in an office with a 9-to-5 job. So I knew that it was possible to kind of create a reality that I wanted to create. And, you know, it's daunting, but, and I did, like, after finishing the TAT, like, I got sucked in. I almost opened another bike shop in Petaluma, California. And I moved out there to do that. And then within just a couple of months of being out there, I was just like, no, I can't do this. Like, I gotta keep following this dream. After that point, I had kind of abandoned that notion had stayed on the road and just following my, I guess dream. You know, it changes all the time. It's like, where do I want to go? What do I want to see? I think what I like about it and what I love about it so much is just the different, the exposure I get to other people, other places, mm-hmm. other ways of living, other ways of surviving, and new perspectives. It's just all really fresh, and I just really like to absorb that and experience that, and just see different places in nature, and be totally engrossed in nature as well. I think that just makes me feel so good. So,
as someone, you know, right, like yourself, who went from being a business owner to living, like, a, you know, in quotes, alternate lifestyle, how have your values changed? And, like, you know, what are you pursuing now, and how is that, like, satisfying you, I guess? Because I think a lot of people are afraid to take the plunge, or I also think too, like, we're so set up to pursue wealth in a monetary or a possessions kind of format. How have your ideas of that changed, your ideas of wealth?
Yeah. So what I pursue, you know, what I pursue now is freedom and happiness. You know, and maybe the way I was brought up was to pursue success and, you know, financial stability, a family, you know, a job, like all these things. But I've kind of distilled it down to freedom and happiness. And I think the freedom for me is that semi-nomadic aspect. Like, I don't like being tied down. I don't necessarily like to be told how to do things all the time. I've kind of always been like that as a person. And I think that's also part of my entrepreneurship spirit as well. And I believe that, you know, there are times, and, you know, first taking that plunge was really scary. And, you know, people doubt you, and they're kind of like, oh, going off the deep end, you know, like, totally. And you sometimes do that to yourself. Like, I had a little bit of that going on at the beginning of this whole pandemic. It was like, what am I doing? Like, but what I find is that if you are pursuing like something you're passionate about or that you feel strongly about, or like, you know, for me, it's freedom and happiness. Like if I keep that as my ultimate goal and focus, like I find that I have enough inspiration and like work capacity and motivation to go after anything that, you know, that I want, you know, like as long as I have the energy for it, I can kind of make it happen. And so opportunities present themselves. And I think if you just keep pursuing what you're passionate about, those opportunities will show up. Like, it's not like, there'll just be dead silent. Like if you work for it, it will happen.
And so now you are a route maker, a writer. You do work with organizations like the WTF Bike Explorers. You run Ruta del Jefe. What does being a route maker mean? And like, what do all of, you know, like what are all these little things, and how do you sustain yourself, excuse me, now?
Right, because I'm not really one, like only one of, you know, I just do whatever I can do to, you know, make money with the skill sets that I have, mm-hmm. you know. And so I guess in the route maker realm, I will either create routes and publish route guides for those routes, or I will write route guides for other routes. And so, you know, I've done this for Lonely Planet and bikepacking.com mostly. And so that's kind of where my route maker, and I do it for a lot of, you know, events too. But yeah, so that's kind of where the route maker kind of comes in. The writing, you know, again, I'll write stories for different magazines or blogs or whatever, and for myself, and just the focus there is just to kind of just share the joy that cycling brings me and the experiences that cycling brings me, and to hopefully inspire other people to you know, pursue what their dreams are, or to gain, you know, share the information I've gained through cycling. And then, yeah, so then I'm a co-founder of the, WTF Bike Explorers organization, which stands for Women, Trans, Femme, and Non-Binary Cyclists who use their bikes to explore. And so we've put on a couple summits, annual summits, bringing together a bunch of voices to share skills, stories, and essentially just build a nationwide, and it's growing globally, a community of WTF cyclists who are connected with one another and can inspire one another to take space in different, you know, whatever it is, whatever cycling that they're interested in. And so my focus this year has been to create a WTF Bike Explorers gravel team. We've got this team and they're, you know, promoting the values that WTF Bike Explorers promotes. So we've got, you know, if you go to our website, we've got a guiding principles for all companies to kind of take up, and also a cycling industry pledge that promotes more inclusivity and diversity within the cycling industry. We have a podcast. We're going to have a publication coming out this summer. So just a whole bunch of different things kind of focused on this WTF community.
And I want to know, like, can you talk a bit about the cycling industry pledge? Because I think that, you know, like what you're doing is obviously pretty unique, but it's calling. I think it's given a call out to the wider cycling community, and particularly cycling businesses, right? To kind of, you know, become more diverse, become more progressive, and also too more sustainable, just like in kind of, I guess, thoughtful. Can you talk about the pledge?
Yeah. The idea behind the pledge is to give businesses kind of like a tool set, or just like some guidelines to kind of focus their hiring initiatives and their marketing initiatives towards. And so it's not always putting like a white male on the center of your marketing campaign, or, you know, making sure that you have your pulling from a larger pool of candidates from for a job position, because all those alternative perspectives, those diverse perspectives of the people that you hire, will impact your business to be overall more inclusive and diverse. And so it's just pushing companies to be more aware of that in their hiring and in their marketing. And so that more people can feel included in the cycling community. And we're reaching out to people and saying, hey, we want you here. This space is for you.
And how has the response been?
There has been a really, really good response. A lot of businesses and organizations have signed the pledge. We have them all listed on our website. So the response has been good, which tells us that all these companies and these businesses want to do this. They might not know how to do it, though. And so that's why they're signing the pledge. And they're saying, hey, we're going to try to do these things. The key for our next stage for WTF is just checking in with these companies and just being like, hey, how's it going? Like, have you been making any progress? And, you know, obviously it's really easy to sign a pledge and just get your logo placed on a website saying, hey, you know, I've done this. And so, you know, we'll be checking in on companies and seeing if they are making the changes, and if they aren't, you know, they'll be removed. But, like, you know, it's a learning progress for everyone involved. It's for us and for them. And, we're just trying to figure out how to do this. And, WTF Bike Explorers, I think, is just, kind of initiating these conversations on like a more larger scale with the audience that we have. We're just kind of bringing these conversations to light. And we're doing the same. We're kind of starting a new campaign on events, specifically on how events and event organizers can be more inclusive and make their events more safe.
And where can our listeners find more information out about the WTF? How can they support, or how can they, you know, go and find out a bit more about the pledge, as well as your guiding principles?
Yeah, so just go to www.wtfbikeexplorers, bikeexplorers is spelled with one E, .com. And on that page, you'll be given the opportunity to check out the Cycling Industry Pledge. Under About Us, you can find our guiding principles. And I'm pretty sure on the main page, there's a donate button, and you can donate to WTF Bike Explorers. We create scholarships for WTF cyclists every year. So we give people financial stipends and gear to support them on their first adventure, or their next adventure, if they don't have access to the funds and or the privilege that some other folks do.
Awesome. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, so people can just click through. Let's talk about Ruta del Jefe, another example of you using the bike to do good, but in this case, this extends very much beyond just cycling. This is using cycling and sport to talk about a larger issue and engage with an issue in a really intimate way. How did that event come about?
So Ruta del Jefe is a adventure cycling event that I have started. I started 2 years ago, and it's held in southern Arizona, just 10 miles north of the border with Mexico. It's also held in one of the most biodiverse regions of the world. So you get a place that has over like 500 different species of birds. And you've got pronghorn antelope, you've got, you can have black bear, and you can have jaguar all in the same, same region. Grasslands mixed with, you know, your typical desert cactus landscape. So it's a very diverse, environment, and also with the species there. And so I started riding there back in 2017. And once I went there once, I think I went back like seven times in the same year to just like scout different places. And just because I love the riding. It's like mellow, it's relatively mellow riding. You've got climbing, but there's shorter climbs, and it's not overly steep in a lot of places. And the scenery changes really frequently. And the dirt roads, there's just an amazing network of dirt roads. So I like being able to map something in a place that has like lots of different scenic changes along the ride. But at the same time, as I started going down there, I started realizing like all this stuff that I'd never been exposed to before, like border patrol agent checkpoints, surveillance blimps, and just the border wall itself. I started reading more about the region and what was happening down there, and just learning that the area that I was riding in and that I was really enjoying riding in is actually a location where a lot of migrants cross the border. It's a very dangerous journey. It's one of the most remote sections of the Sonora Desert. And so thousands of migrants are attempting to make this journey every year, and they're traveling by foot through this landscape. I'm just like loving to roll around, but on my two wheels, but to imagine having to go through the brush and the cactus like by foot is just mind-blowing. And so many migrants, thousands of migrants have died on that journey in that region, and humanitarian aid has been attacked in that region. At the same time, there's lots of like mining interests trying to get in there and just ruin and destroy habitats for jaguars. I decided with like that, you know, I had established, I had made a bikepacking route for the area. And with that, I wrote a pretty thorough guide with like all the various different environmental and like political issues that were kind of happening in the region. Because after reading about it, I was kind of like, oh, you know, I can't really like make this a rosy picture. You know, this is actually right. Kind of, the writing might be rosy and beautiful, but really it's the whole place is tainted with all these different issues that really can threaten the future. And so I felt like it was a good opportunity to bring people to a place and educate them or like raise their awareness to the various issues that are taking place in the southern Arizona borderland. So I decided eventually to host do the Ruta del Jefe event. And with that, the night before the race, I bring in experts and people who who are representatives of various organizations that are doing work to protect the borderlands and to raise awareness of the humanitarian aid issues and the environmental issues kind of like plaguing this region. And so the experts kind of speak to the riders the night before, and then the next day the riders go and do the race, which the official race is 125 mile dirt road kind of adventure route.
And how's the community's response been to that, like within the cycling world, you know, having this added purpose to an event, and you know, having that, you know, that night before where you have the experts talk about these issues, what's the response been like and what's the engagement been like?
Yeah, I mean, it's been anyone that has come to the event, I've just heard things that people are just inspired to create events. They see the simplicity of what I'm doing and they are like, yeah, this is actually something that I could be doing in my region that I feel passionately about and in protecting or in helping. Like they see it as a way that they can engage and like have a voice against some of these issues. And just also the ability to like learn about a place and then go ride in it and ride in it. You have just a whole new sense of appreciation and, appreciation for the place, I think, is what makes it powerful.
And I'm curious, right? It sounds like, you know, through your riding, well, not it sounds like it was, right? Through you riding in that region, you kind of discovered these issues and you developed an attachment to them in enough conviction about them, right, in order to host an event down there. And I'm curious, like, to hear how you believe sport, and I guess specifically cycling, can be used to help tackle some, you know, I guess pretty major issues, right? You're talking about immigration down here, you're talking about land use, and I'm just curious to hear how you think you can be, like how that's effective, and it's, I guess it's that evolution of sport, right, into this new realm of social responsibility.
Yeah, I think, so I've always felt like, and I learned this through bike touring, is when you're bike touring through a place, you are kind of like stripping yourself down into being like the most unintimidating, like vulnerable person that you are. You're like pretty dependent on your outside environment. And so when you're traveling across the country, you're traveling through really conservative places or really, really liberal places, and you talk to everyone, you know, and everybody, you know, at their core has kindness and they can connect, you know. It doesn't, you know, you don't talk about politics, like, you know, you just talk about human things. And so I think that the bicycle has this ability to bridge a gap of polarization in a way. It has the ability to like humanize people and expose people to each other, you know, expose yourself to the people you wouldn't normally choose to put yourself near. And so a lot of great conversations can happen from that alone. But I guess I think that the cycling industry, like when it comes to, I think that, you know, we have to start thinking about the places that we're riding. They have a history to them. We can't just keep going along and just living in this like this fantasy land where it's just cycling and all I want to do is just ride my bike and stop thinking about the world's issues, you know. Like, I think that that's okay, and I think you can still do that, but you still can't push out the reality of the history and the issues at hand. So I think that cycling has a great opportunity to help tell a story of a place and grow people's appreciation. And if their appreciation is grown and they can connect with something in that place, they'll have a better understanding and they'll be able to communicate with their friends or be able to just know what to look for and to read about. So I think it's a small thing, but it can have a kind of a trickling effect and just a greater education and awareness around things.
And on those points, right, you did a big trip last year in South America. Do you want to tell me a bit about how that went and you know, what kind of an experience that was? I understand it was, you know, got pretty intense at times.
Yeah. So we went to South America twice last year. First in the summer, we went to Peru and we had a great time. It was my first time in Peru and I just fell in love with the place. And before we got back from that trip, we had already made plans to go back in November and check out this other region that we were going to start in La Paz, Bolivia. And so we went back in November, the beginning of November, and we arrived in La Paz the day that a lot of rioting and protests started to happen against the a general election for the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales. Mm-hmm. And so what was happening was that there are just lots of people in the streets protesting the legality of they thought that he had corrupted the election process in some way, and there was an investigation about that, and people were upset. And he had been in power for 14 years already. He was a super like socialist. Or had socialist values as a leader, and he brought a lot of people out of poverty. And so he did a lot of good things, but again, people were really questioning what he was doing. And so, yeah, when over the next few days, we just kind of watched as La Paz just kind of deteriorated into this whole just mass protests. Eventually, the police joining the protests and then eventually the resignation of Evo Morales, and then kind of the aftermath of that, which was pretty bad, which was with the military coming in and kind of showing their power and there was just a lot of violence and intensity for a few days. And so we eventually got out of there. We flew to Arequipa and started our bike tour from there. But yeah, that was a really intense time, and it was very confusing because the news that I was reading wasn't capturing the entire picture of what was happening down there. And so, you know, I was really sympathetic to the protesters against Evo Morales, but after his resignation and kind of the aftermath that happened, I started finding more information about what was happening. And I just felt really disillusioned and kind of manipulated by the news that I was reading. And I'm still kind of getting my head around all that, but it was definitely pretty sad for a large population of people, especially that it's Bolivia has a massive population of indigenous people, and they really did love Morales. But we ended up having a really great bike tour after that.
where did the rest of the trip take you?
It took us down into Chile through this section of national parks through Chile, and just an abundant amount of wildlife and like salt lakes that we rode past. And then eventually we rode across the Salar de Uyuni in a various different, a few different salt flats. So we spent like 5 days riding across salt flats as well. It was pretty incredible.
Nice. And I think that's another like example of, you know, the bike puts you on the ground, right, and gives you a different perspective to everything that's going on. And I think that's, yeah, a very big one of the superpowers of traveling by bike. Before we wrap up, you mentioned at the start of the show, you've just sort of started racing a little bit, right, in the last year. And I'm just intrigued, right? I understand what you get from traveling by bike and understand the power of the bike. And I'm intrigued to hear as well, like, what do you get from racing and what do you get out of that challenge?
Yeah, for me, it's mostly for just the personal challenge of seeing if I can do something that I didn't think was possible. So it's like, it's kind of testing the fitness I gained through bike touring, which I just think it's wonderful that I just trained through like essentially bike touring, and it's testing that fitness and seeing what I can do with it, you know. And it just makes me just so happy that, like, you know, 5 years ago looking at the Dirty Kansas, I'd be like, there is no way in hell I can do that race. And, you know, now I've done it twice, and you know, I feel like I could do more than that. And it's like, you know, it's just a great feeling. And now I'm just trying to like get a better time, you know? And so I like that whole aspect. I like how I can make, you know, each time I attempt something like that, I can do it in a way that my body doesn't hurt as much, or I just feel better doing it. So that's always fun. But I know it's definitely, you know, bike touring definitely is, and kind of like adventure riding is definitely my top. And then like doing those races and challenges are like, those are secondary for sure.
Well, I feel like it just reminded me of a story you told me a while back, but and it involves Ultra Romance. So Ron and Lord Adam, about your journey to the start of your first ever Dirty Kansas. Can you just like real quick give me a rundown of that? Because it's a very classic Ron adventure, and I feel like it's worth telling.
Yeah. We decided that we were going to ride to Dirty Kansas, and that would help us train because neither one of us were in very good shape at the time. And so we're like, okay, let's make this, you know, fun for us. And so we decided to bike tour it from Durango. And so I created a route, and I flew to Durango. And I remember specifically in that, you know, day before we left for the route, we were looking over the route, and we're like, well, yeah, we're definitely going to get, you know, have to hike our bikes through some snow over this first range in the San Juan to get out of Durango. Mm-hmm. And so we discussed ideas like bringing some like small snowshoes, you know, like we talked about this stuff. and then we like we looked up how to make snowshoes if we needed to out of like pine trees. And we did all just talk. But expecting some hardship, I booked the cabin at the top of the first pass. So, you know, we start the tour and we get to that mountain pass, the first mountain pass. And it's a lot more snow than we had thought. Adam and Benedict were both wearing sandals. And we hiked our bikes through snow for like 6 miles that night. And just, you know, getting to the top of the ridge in darkness and being like, we can't find the cabin. We've been walking through like just like blanket of snow, so we couldn't really see where the road or the trail was, and so we're like, oh well, this is it, you know, we're gonna have to camp in the snow, I guess, like that's not what we planned for. And but at the last minute we found the cabin, And you know, they had a little bit of frostbite on their toes. And we, you know, melted snow, and yeah, and so that was like, that was the hardest part of the trip, and then it all kind of was fun and dandy after that, except for once we dropped Adam off in Pueblo, and Adam went back to Durango, and Benedict and I continued on as soon as we hit like eastern Colorado and western Texas, I mean western Kansas, we just, it was so boring compared to what we had experienced in Colorado, and we were just like, oh, this is terrible. And then the final nail on the coffin was we got just stuck in this massive hailstorm with golf ball size hail, and there's like no trees around, you know, we just got in a ditch like with our bikes and hid behind our frame bags, and luckily we were like 15 minutes away from an Amtrak, and we were like, oh, we're just gonna take a Amtrak the rest of the way. So we took an Amtrak to about 200 miles of Emporia, and then rode the rest of the way there. But the whole time, I mean, the story here is that the whole time, you know, Benedict has his bike like loaded down. He's like miles behind me on this bike tour. Like, I'm like, God, he is gonna really suffer at Dirty Kansas. Like, he's not doing so well. I am crushing him. And he was also like building me up as well. He's like, oh, you're gonna do so good, Sarah. And so I'm like, okay, well, I'm gonna do good. And you know, I didn't even think of him, you know, as a threat at the time. And so we line up at Dirty Kansas after having like three luxurious days of just, you know, laying around in a hotel room. We line up at the start line, and the gun goes off, and Benedict takes off. Like, I'm like, oh my gosh, what is happening? Like, I cannot hang on to his wheel. This is like, this is not good. Like, and so I let him go, and he's off, you know, at the front. And the whole time I'm like, shit, I didn't even think, like, he cannot beat me. I cannot let him beat me. And so I just like pedaled as hard as I could for those first 100 miles. And I caught up to him at the 100 mile rest point. And he was just ripped apart into pieces. This is kind of gross, but my mom watched him pee his pants in the fetal and child's pose. My mom was waiting for me there. And so she got exposed to the whole everything. And so it was time to go from the 100 mile, and I was like, this is your chance, Benedict, like, I'm going, you know, I'm leaving, you know, and he couldn't go, he wasn't ready, and so I took off, and I eventually did beat him on that, and he hasn't beaten me at a gravel race yet.
Benedict in child's pose peeing himself at the 100 mile mark is absolutely priceless. I feel very sorry for your mother for having to experience that.
I do too, but I figured, you know, if she was gonna if there's one way to meet him, you know, you just might as well get full exposure, you know, first time. Then he can surprise her all the other times.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Before we wrap it up, last question. You know, what are your plans next? What do you have on the horizon coming out of the COVID-19 situation?
Yeah. I am supposed to race gravel for Specialized this year. So I am signed up for like the Rift in Iceland, SBT Gravel and Steamboat, Dirty Kansas. And so I have gravel events that I am supposed to do. With the whole COVID thing, that's very much in the air. I don't know what the future of events are. I'm having a hard time envisioning a reality where there would be events without focus on testing that we don't have. I've also, you know, like, I was supposed to be in Italy. Like, I'm supposed to be in Italy right now. We're supposed to go back to Peru on June 9th. So all of my trips are canceled, and so I'm just kind of like taking it day by day. I still have, sponsorships. That's kind of one aspect of my like career that I didn't really mention, but it's also one of the more like financial supporting aspects of my career is just various sponsorships through Specialized and Live with GPS and just different gigs that I have with companies. And so I still have those. But trips are canceled. And so I'm just kind of focusing on being here in Durango, kind of thinking about what I can do from here. I'm thinking about like tours from here eventually. But for now, it's just, staying inspired by kind of exploring my own backyard and just enjoying that. And I'm really enjoying that right now. And I think I'll just keep doing this until something else changes and just not being too stuck on anything right now. You know, everything is going to change or could change or won't change, you know, like you just got to be okay with whatever's happening.
Right. You're exactly right. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, Sarah. So thank you so much. And see what happens, and we'll be following your adventures keenly. And we'll, when the world reopens and we can move again, we'll no doubt catch up and go for a ride.
That would be great. It was a pleasure to see you again, talk to you again.
And that is the program for this week. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's been a real hoot. We will be back next week with another episode of Thereabouts Outspoken. But until then, feel free to do whatever you like. Take a short walk, or a long one maybe. Perhaps a ride through the woods. Enjoy a nice meal. Or perhaps peruse some old episodes of our potentially award-winning podcast. Where can you find the episodes at?
Yeah, we are trying to climb the charts. So make sure you... Hold on, that's a good line. Let's get that. We are trying to climb the charts to get those awards. So, we would appreciate if you subscribe to everywhere you could find this podcast, Apple and Spotify and SoundCloud. And
you can reach us, howdy@thereabouts.co, or hit us up on Instagram @hereortthereabouts. Keep the comments and suggestions coming. Thanks, everybody, for listening. My name is Angus Morton, reporting from the Rocky Mountain Range.
And I'm Isaac Carson, reporting from the Pacific Northwest. Still. Yes.
Can we do that again? Take it from the top?